an Australian expert on a range of topics. He's visiting South Africa and involved in a series of meetings and speaking events in Johannesburg. Professor Michelle Grossman is a specialist in, amongst other things, radicalization, community resilience, cultural diversity, community engagement, racism, discrimination, refugee resettlement, police community relations, and refugee resettlement. She's well known to the Australian government and is widely published. Welcome her on the airwaves of Radio Islam International to discuss some of her views. Professor Michelle, good morning to you and welcome to the program on Radio Islam.
Good morning, and thank you so much for having me on your program.
Thank you for joining us. Welcome to our country. You've been in the country since yesterday. We had the opportunity of listening to some of your discourses at the Jamiatul Ulama, our head office, yesterday afternoon. What are your first impressions of the country and its people?
Well, my first impressions of South Africa as a country and its people are overwhelmingly positive. My very strong sense is that South Africa is a country full of welcoming people. I've been especially struck, of course, as a cultural diversity researcher myself, by the very strong multiculturalism that I've seen in South Africa, and particularly the way in which there is such goodwill in South Africa around people from different cultural backgrounds, different racial backgrounds, and different faith backgrounds. Pardon me, getting along with each other. So it's been a terrific introduction to South Africa, and that has been borne out by the discussions that I've had with the people I've been meeting with so far.
We understand that you've traveled to a number of countries before coming to South Africa. What is the purpose of your visit to South Africa and this entire, what we could say, is a lecture tour or speaking tour?
Yes, thank you for that question. I am a guest of the Australian High Commission, who invited me to undertake a speaking tour in three countries, beginning with Nigeria, then Kenya, and concluding with South Africa. So my last visit is in your wonderful country. And the purpose of the visit was really twofold. First of all, it was an opportunity for me to learn more about approaches to countering violent extremism and engaging with communities on issues surrounding radicalization to violence and how these are playing out in a number of different African countries, so obviously both in West and East Africa and, of course, now in South Africa. And it was also an opportunity for me to be able to share some of the approaches that we are taking in Australia, lessons that we have learned as we attempt to deal with some of the challenges presented by radicalization to violence, and to explore what kinds of connections and opportunities there might be to help build our international knowledge base in all these countries about what really is working and also about what isn't working, directions that we might want to pursue in future. So that really was the purpose of the visit.
Yes, and really, really important considering how things are panning out across the globe. Now, community cohesion and community resilience are two things that we as a country know firsthand, and it was especially important after the dawn of democracy. But now, 22 years in our new democracy, there's a sense that communities are being pulled apart with unemployment, anger, the slow pace of service delivery, inequality driving violent service delivery protests, xenophobia, and other social ills. Are we, as Africans, perhaps in your assessment, too impatient? Should we be more patient and give the process more time?
It's a little hard for me, having only been in the country for a couple of days, it's probably a little difficult for me to comment with any real sense of knowledge or credibility on those issues. I feel that I would need to spend quite a bit more time here and probably do some further research of my own to say anything definitive. But let me make a more general point, because of course we deal with some of these issues in Australia as well. I think that both community cohesion, which is the ability of people, which is the ability of people from different backgrounds and sectors of society to stick together on issues that really matter and to find common cause with each other. That's a rough definition of community cohesion. Community resilience is the ability to thrive despite adversity and challenges and to be able to develop effective coping strategies that help people move through hard times and difficult times and come out okay at the other end. So both community cohesion and community resilience, they are long-term projects. There are no quick fixes, and these are both areas where what we really need to concentrate on is the long view. So whether or not patience comes into it, that's an interesting perspective. I think that what you often see when you're looking to strengthen community resilience is that it is a fairly slow process. You can make progress in some areas, but you can also find yourself sliding back. The issues that you're raising around a faltering economy and the way in which people respond to that, I think that those are challenges often in the external environment that we can't control. The key issue is how, as a society, we cope with those challenges. And that's really where community resilience comes in. So one of the things that I've observed in a number of countries that I've visited, and certainly in Australia, one of the things that is problematic, and I've seen it in my own country, is when we're faced with a set of external challenges, some of them are global. For example, the economy is faltering in many places all around the world, and it's well beyond our capacity to control. But when we stop simply at the point at which we cast blame and say these people are responsible or this organization is responsible, this government is responsible, that may be true. But if we only stop there and we don't work together to try to find solutions about how we're going to get through a particular crisis, that's when we start to lose our resilience. So a big part of community resilience and a big part of community cohesion means avoiding the fracturing that you were describing, where societies feel that different groups are being pulled away from each other. The important thing is to try to find or rebuild those bridges that help us connect, because it is only through cooperation with each other, and it is only through trying to understand the different perspectives and needs that we may have, that we are going to make any progress.
Around the world, there's a struggle where radicalism is concerned. Even in South Africa, we had cases of teenagers and families trying to reach Syria to join ISIS. What is behind the radicalism and violent extremism? And again, this is not only a problem associated with Muslims around the world who make the decision to join radical groups such as ISIS. Yet back in South Africa, we've also seen young people becoming more radical in their fight for better education and the eradication of inequality.
I think there are a number of different theories and perspectives on why people radicalize to violence and what the root causes are. The research that we do in Australia, as well as a lot of research around the world, tends to suggest the following. People radicalize to violence, first of all, for a number of different reasons. So I think it's a mistake to try to isolate or identify a single cause. We also know that local and regional contexts have a very significant influence in what the drivers to radicalization to violence might be in particular settings and particular contexts. Having said that, there are a number of things that we can identify in common, particularly for young people. One thing that emerges very clearly is that where young people feel that they and the groups that they belong to, or the identities that they have, whether those identities are cultural, whether they're religious, whether they're racial or so forth, when they feel that who they are means that they are subject to humiliation, to discrimination, and bias, made to feel as if they're not worthwhile, this can actually be a significant trigger, because across the board we see that people who become radicalized to violence have usually had some experience somewhere in their lives where they have experienced that loss of dignity, loss of a sense of respect, loss of sense of self-worth. And radicalization to violence can appear to them as a way of restoring those things. Sense of injustice, and sense of unfairness in the world can be another significant element in radicalizing to violence. Beyond those, what you might call sort of psychosocial dimensions, I think one of the really key elements is social networks and peer networks. So unlike older analyses that really focused on economic drivers, you know, and said, well, if people are marginalized, if they're economically deprived, they radicalize to violence, that theory really, I think, hasn't stood the test of time for two reasons. One, because we see that a number of people who radicalize to violence are actually very well educated and in many cases actually very well off economically. And the second is that if economic drivers alone were primarily responsible for radicalizing to violence, we would see an enormous number of people around the world who are doing just that, and yet we don't. So I think that particular perspective probably is not as meaningful as perhaps people thought it was a while ago. What is meaningful is the influence in social and peer networks. So people are more likely to radicalize to violence when they are within a social network where there are strong influences that are directing and shaping their thinking to propose that violence is an answer and that violence provides a solution to grievances. Now, we know that it doesn't. We know that violence, in fact, breeds more violence and that it creates a never-ending cycle with no hope in sight. But it can be hard to get that message through to young people, and I think that we really have to concentrate on how best to get that message across. I also think that the third element in the case of many young people is a sense of hopelessness, where you feel that you have no real opportunities for your future, and where you feel that you're staring down a tunnel where things aren't ever going to change. That again can make radicalization to violence look like the answer. And what that means is that as a society, we have to be very clear about the obligation that we have to provide meaningful alternatives to violence in terms of genuine hopes for the future, and how young people in particular can be part of shaping their own future for generations to come.
Professor Michel, what's your view on how Europe is dealing with the influx of refugees from war-torn countries such as Syria? Many of them are Muslim.
Look, this is what they refer to as a wicked problem. Let me first, before I move on to Europe, say something about Australia. As many of your listeners would know, Australia has a mixed picture on the topic of refugee settlement. On the one hand, for many, many years, Australia has been one of the largest takers of refugees and asylum seekers, actually going back to the 1970s when we were the first country to take the many thousands of refugees coming over by boat from Vietnam. And that picture has continued very consistently through refugee intakes via the United Nations Refugee Commission into the present, including our current program to resettle 12,000 Syrian refugees in Australia. However, we also have seen in Australia increased attention given to border control and particularly to resettling our refugees attempting to come over to Australia by boat from Indonesia in offshore detention camps. And that has attracted a lot of public criticism right around the world. So we have a mixed picture, I think, in anybody's objective assessment in Australia. However, what we haven't done, and I don't believe that Australia will ever find itself in this position, what we haven't done is given in to the kind of xenophobia and fear of other people, including, I would suggest, fear of Muslims, that has dominated the European debate and discourse about this. So the way in which Europe is now proposing to handle the refugee crisis and the way in which the discourse there is being dominated in a number of respects by highly conservative right-wing perspectives that are effectively rejecting people on the basis of who they are. So it's that shift from, you know, how do people behave to who they are in terms of identity. And in my view, this is a fundamental mistake and will do a great deal of damage, not only to the people who are seeking relief from persecution and suffering and death, but it will also damage Europe's long-term interests long-term into the future.
It has been fascinating chatting to you this morning, Professor Michelle. You've given great insight on the issue of radicalization, also a very balanced view. We wish you the best for the remaining stay in South Africa, and we appreciate your time on Radio Islam. Thank you very much for taking out the time.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me on your program, and all the best to you and your wonderful country.
Thank you. Have a good stay. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.